Get ready for a journey into the heart of Bridgeport politics with In Absentia, a new podcast from Connecticut Public's investigative team, The Accountability Project. Learn about the city's past and present political dysfunction and the systems that enable it. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts.
Funding provided by Gregory Melville and Susan Fox and Kathleen Bromage.
Let me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man.
I think that's probably Steve Forbes' best record. No, those are the Beatles. The Beatles didn't like paying taxes. George Harrison wrote that song because the minute they got money, they realized they didn't get to keep all of it. How unfair. So I should say on a personal note before we begin this show that my tax preparer has been the same person for decades and decades and decades. I don't know how far back it goes. Probably begins in the 80s. We're still together. It's one of the relationships I have that's really survived. And one, he's a good tax preparer and he makes it pretty painless. But I think his biggest feature is he's funny. And so for years, I would show up for my appointment with him and he would, it was almost a tradition, he would slide a page across the desk to me. And it would always, and he would say, for example, "Have you done any Navajo ceremonies of any kind in the past year?" And then he would slide the relevant, you know, tax code page across to me. Or I remember there was one year where he said, "Did you take any kickbacks this year? Because you have to declare those," which is actually true. You do. I mean, it's kind of like how they got Capone, sort of, you know, and if you make certain kinds of income concealment illegal, even though it's illegal in the first place, you can often prosecute on that basis. Anyway, the point is there are a lot of those pages with weird stuff on them. And together, I mean, they don't operate in isolation, right? Together, they combine to make a spider web of forms and forms that you have to fill out only to find out that the main result of filling out the form is that there are other forms that you now have to fill out. So it's way too complicated. And as we'll talk about later in the show, there's considerable evidence that the wealthiest people don't even really do it, or at least they get a very different outcome than you and I get. Towards the end of the show, we'll actually talk to somebody who, as a point of principle, as kind of a war resister, doesn't pay the portion of his taxes in the tradition of Henry David Thoreau that would have gone for military buildup and exercises. All right, joining us now to get the whole conversation started is Monica Prasad, professor of economic and political sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to our conversation.
Thanks for inviting me.
So reading a little bit of your work, I know that you do a very good job, a much better job than I just did, of clarifying why the tax code is way too complicated or evidence that the tax code is way too complicated. I don't know, just if you were to explain that in a very general way over the course of about 60 seconds or so, what would you say?
Yeah, well, one reason we know that the way we do our taxes is very different is how you can examine what's happening in other countries. And just to get things started, one of my favorite stories about this is the journalist T.R. Reid was in the Netherlands. He was there the day before taxes were due. He was hanging out with this business executive. So a guy who makes, you know, a six-figure income, has lots of investments, lots of mortgages, a couple of kids in private school, etc. It's the day before taxes are due, and he hasn't started his taxes, right? And so Thierry says to him, "Oh, how do you do your taxes?" And the guy says, "You know, well, I open a beer, I go online, the government has filled out the tax form for me. I look it over and I click accept. And, you know, sometimes it takes 5 minutes. Sometimes there will be something that I have to correct." And this guy is outraged. He says, "In those cases, it takes me up to half an hour to do my taxes. I cannot believe it." And so this is the tax filing experience that people have in just many, many other countries. And that is not the experience that we have here. So as most of us are suffering through right now.
Right. So as an example of one approach to this, let's hear the conscientious neighbor of Homer Simpson, Ned Flanders, as he's deciding when to start working on his taxes. This is a zero maestro.
Oh, January 1st. Better get going on those taxes, Nettie. Let's see. Cash register, Inc. Well, that's a business expense, isn't it? But then I do enjoy the smell of this stuff, don't I? Better not risk it.
So, Monica, this has now become two different things. One of the things is figuring out how much you owe. It may be more than what has been withheld. I mean, after all of your work, you may be getting yourself giving yourself a bad message or getting one from your tax preparer. But there's also just the effort of it, just the hours and hours of wading through this stuff. Either you're going to do it, or you're going to pay somebody else to do it, or you're going to buy a computer program to do it. And that in and of itself seems counterproductive, like just a really, I don't know if we can go the Netherlands way, but I gather a lot of other countries don't have you try to figure out how much you owe. Somebody said it was sort of like, you know, telling your credit card provider how much you think you owe for your credit card payment.
That's Joseph Bankman. That's his analogy. It's as if Visa were to tell you, you know, fill out this empty form and tell us how much you think you owe, and we'll tell you if you're right. So yeah, it's not just the Netherlands. Australia, the UK, Finland, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, lots and lots of countries do it this way. And there's no reason we couldn't do that here also, because in many cases, the government already knows what you were telling them. You know, so it knows your income from your W-2, it knows your interest, your dividends, it knows your capital gains, it knows your mortgage interest. 90% of people don't actually itemize their deductions. They take the standard deduction. So it's definitely possible to do these pre-filled tax returns. Right now, we spend about 13 hours on average, and we spend about $240 doing this. And more than that, I would say, is just the fear that people have of making a mistake. You know, there's this worry that what if I put it in the wrong line? What if I add an extra zero or take off an extra zero? Who knows what's going to happen? There's for most people, there's really no reason to do that. State level versions of what's called pre-filled tax returns have been tried here in California. It's been tried. It's very, very popular. There's a couple of reasons why it doesn't tend to work here.
Well, let's talk about what those reasons are. You get going on this. Tell us what some of the reasons why it doesn't work.
Okay, yeah. So the first one I want to talk about, among sociologists, I'm usually the one who is saying we shouldn't exaggerate the importance of business lobbying. You know, we should look at the evidence. It's really more complicated than that. But this example that I'm going to tell you, this is just so cynical. It's just so cold. So it's the early 2000s, right? The George W. Bush administration. The IRS decides it wants to put out a free filing system for low-income taxpayers. Intuit, the makers of TurboTax, are not very happy at the idea of a free filing system for low-income taxpayers. So they talk to the IRS, they talk to the government, they lobby them. They say, well, we have all of this infrastructure here. We should put out the free version. And the IRS agrees to let them do that. So, you know, we're going to have this free version for taxpayers who are eligible for it. And then they do everything they can to hide the free version. They make it invisible to search engines. And then they do other stuff. They do, this is crazy, they create two versions of a program. One is called the Freedom Edition, and the other is called the Free Edition. All right, so the Freedom Edition is the version of this that is free to low-income taxpayers. The Free Edition, on the other hand, is not. You got that?
Yes. And let me see if I can help out. Here's a commercial for the TurboTax Free Edition. This is from 2021. You're going to see it set at a livestock auction. It's a TV commercial. Farmers attending the auction are putting up their placards to bid for cows at the price of free. Here's a little bit of what it sounds like. A1, sir.
And free and free and free and free and free, not a better damn free, damn free, damn hit free here, free wire down, get free down, get free down, or damn, make it free. Hit free here and free down, no, free, make it free.
That's right. TurboTax Free Edition is free. Free, 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 free.
All right, Monica, continue.
Yeah, so hearing that, you might think that it would be free, right? That's not exactly what happens. So what they do is they get you to enter lots and lots of information, right? Only after you've spent about an hour putting this information in do they tell you that you don't actually qualify. So because you don't want to do it, you know, want to go through the whole process again, you just end up paying. So, right, so there's this free edition, there's this freedom edition, there's some of this is invisible to search engines. In the end, this supposed free software actually ends up getting lots of new paying clients. Another thing they do is that if you did actually manage to get through this and got the free version 1 year, which about 3% of people who were eligible actually managed to do, the next year they will send you an email with a link. You click on the link sends you to the paid version. So the best minds of the country are going to things like this. You know, you have to feel sorry for them, all this creativity and all this energy that is going towards this thing that is ultimately destructive, but they get very, very rich.
Okay, so let's talk about the second reason. The second reason has to do pretty typically with Republican politics. Ronald Reagan said that paying your taxes should be hard, should be unpleasant, so you won't want to do it, so you'll insist on a different kind of tax system or lower taxes. We also remember very specifically, and perhaps to his ultimate doom, his successor, George H.W. Bush. This is Mr. Reyes, our special clip. Here we go.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say to them, read my lips. No new taxes.
And we all remember how that wound up. That was 88, 92. By 92, actually, there had been new taxes. He'd had to negotiate with the Democrats in Congress. And now that was stuck to him like a piece of toilet paper as he walked out of the bathroom. But say a little bit more about this, Monica. If you're essentially running as one of your principal defining features of your political party, an anti-tax position, you may not be interested in simplifying taxes.
Yeah, there's a funny thing that happens here. So there's a couple of different things going on. One is that there is this strain in the Republican Party that is just suspicious of making it too easy to pay taxes. You know, so as you said, Ronald Reagan, when he was governor of California, he says paying taxes should hurt. His idea is that if this is a painful process, you are going to be very aware of how much you pay in taxes and you will resist that. Whereas if it just becomes easier, then you know, you might not notice how much the government is actually taking. You might let the government get bigger than, you know, than you essentially want. But there's another thing that's also going on, which is that if it's your main electoral appeal, to have lower taxes, then you might not want anything that makes that electoral appeal less prominent in people's minds. So there's the ideological reason, but there's also the electoral reason. You know, so you remember Mitt Romney in 2012, he's complaining that 47% of people don't pay taxes. And so that sounds a little strange. You would think, well, shouldn't a party that is anti-tax, shouldn't they be celebrating that? But what he's saying is that these 47% of people are immune to the electoral appeal of low taxes. So both of these things are going on. Grover Norquist, if you remember back in the 2000s, he was sort of the center of the political world. He was kind of the entente terrible of the right. He is pushing this especially for both of these, probably for both of these reasons.
So, just for the sake of conversation, let me ask a question that I think you'll be able to strike down pretty easily. But some people could look at our system and go, well, one of the reasons it's complicated is that by being a progressive system, it tries to be more fair. We have marginal tax rates. You know, historically, I mean, I think the highest marginal tax rate now might be 37%, but historically they've been as high as 90 in the 40s and hovered around the 60s and 70s for a long time. So if there are marginal tax rates, then people are going to want to know how they can get some of their money out of the top or the highest marginal tax rate that it's in, that you create a system where higher increments of earning are taxed at a higher rate, which is a good idea. It seems fair. It seems right to me anyway. But you're also essentially creating a system where people are going to need to find out if they can game it, if they can get it down, if there's anything they can do about it.
Yeah, and this is also something that's a little bit surprising if you compare our tax system to European tax systems. We have always had, at least until Ronald Reagan, actually a more progressive tax system. Our rates were higher than in many other countries. And we also have never had a value-added tax, which is a sort of national sales tax. So we were actually the country with more progressive taxes. And as you say, one thing that happens when you have these 90% taxes is people try to figure out, well, how can I avoid paying these taxes? So we developed this sort of strange hybrid system where we would have these tax rates, but then Congress would say, okay, we'll give you slightly lower rates for doing this, for doing that, you know, all kinds of things. Like growing sugarcane, you can get a tax exemption for. So it's very strange system. No one would design it this way. It's not rational. Reagan comes in 1986 and he says that. He says this doesn't look rational. Let's just close a bunch of the loopholes and then we will lower the rates. So he does that. And then over the next three decades, all of these exemptions creep back into the tax code.
Another thing that has been proposed in the past, in 96 and then again in 2000, Steve Forbes of the Forbes family ran on a flat tax. And his argument was, if you had a flat tax, you could get rid of, as he put it, all 9 million gory words of the tax code, and replace it with a single rate with the generous exemptions for adults and kids, et cetera, et cetera. And it certainly would be simple. The question is, would it still be fair?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds nice. You know, it's always this sort of political appeal. It seems like, oh yeah, a flat tax, why can't we do it? But most people do want at least a little bit of progressivity in the tax code. You know, there's a general sort of American consensus that if you make more money, if America has been good to you, you should give back. You should give back a little bit more than, so there's this elemental commitment to progressivity. And then, you know, there are things that people think, well, there should be deductions for, like, shouldn't there be a deduction for children? You know, shouldn't there be a deduction for medical expenses? Shouldn't there be a deduction? You know, so you start talking on their merits. Every single one of these exemptions often makes sense and has its defenders. So you can see how this creeps back in. And then even if it doesn't make sense, they have their lobbyists, right? So there are some exemptions. Like if you look at them, it literally says this exemption is for any business that was incorporated on July 1, 1982. So literally there was one business that managed to get this thing into the tax code. So it's hard to see, you know, you would have to get rid of the whole system of lobbying if you really wanted to have a flat tax system and preserve a flat tax system.
I mean, another part of this is the federal government is basically, through its tax code, engaging in various kinds of social and economic engineering, particularly about using taxes to encourage the formation of wealth. There's tax breaks for investment, like capital gains and dividends, for savings, like Roth IRAs and health savings accounts, and especially for home ownership. I mean, the mortgage interest deduction, the MID, is sometimes described as welfare for the middle and upper middle class. You are allowed to do something that most poor people can't do. But I mean, I think a lot of the people, public radio listeners listening to this, are very happy to have their mortgage interest deduction. I don't know if it fits into any kind of philosophical or thoughtful way of thinking about a tax system.
Yeah, but you know, even the mortgage interest deduction is reaching fewer and fewer people who aren't genuinely ultra wealthy, like incredibly wealthy. Mm-hmm. Something like 90% of taxpayers now are taking the standard deduction. Trump raised it in his first term. So it's only really the 10% who are just incredibly wealthy who are even benefiting from the mortgage interest deduction. It does have its defenders. And here's another strange little thing about the politics of taxation. It's the Democrats who are defending this highly regressive tax exemption, partly because their constituents are wealthier and live, in the blue states are wealthier than the red states, and so they are the ones who are benefiting from this.
Oh, are you still there? So yeah, I think that's all true. And I've slightly lost my train of thought about this. But yeah, I mean, this is something that goes to fewer and fewer people. Oh, I know what I wanted to ask. This is, and I've never really advocated for Donald Trump ever before in my life. And I'm probably not doing that right now. But it could be argued that what you just described, the so-called tax reform of Donald Trump, which, as we know, preponderantly benefited upper income people. But what it did do is exactly what you say, shift a huge percentage of taxpayers into the standard deduction. I would be one of those taxpayers. And if we're talking about simplification, could it be argued that he actually did move the hockey puck a little bit in that direction? I mean, you know, you're not itemizing anymore. You're not deducting charitable contributions for the most part, things like that. You could say that he pushed us a little closer to the Netherlands, or maybe you couldn't, Monica.
Yeah. I mean, another thing that's happened is in 2019, ProPublica published this amazing piece, just kind of blowing the whistle on what yes. TurboTax is doing.
We're going to be, and by the way, we're going to be talking to one of the authors of that piece in about 2 or 3 minutes. But yeah, this will be a perfect setup. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so that sort of kicked off this whole process in which many people started to pay attention to this. Elizabeth Warren has really been pushing this. And this year, the IRS is experimenting with this direct file program. About 10 or 11% of taxpayers can benefit from that. It isn't exactly the kind of pre-filled thing that I was talking about in the Netherlands, but it is a much simpler sort of process. And I also think that there are a couple of things that are happening that might set us up for more simplification going forward. One is that tax cuts really aren't as important an issue for Republicans these days. They've got a lot of other things going on. And the other is that the FTC ruled against TurboTax, and Letitia James managed to get this huge settlement, something like $141 million, which of course is peanuts for TurboTax. But so some of this lobbying has been reined in, and also some of the political reasons to oppose this might not be quite as germane as they were earlier.
All right, we're going to stop there, but this has been fascinating stuff. I mean, how many people can make the tax code fascinating? Well, Monica Prasad can, professor of economics and political sociology at Johns Hopkins University. Let's take a break. We're going to talk to Paul Keel, one of the people who did that ProPublica article that Monica was just talking about.
Support for this podcast comes from Hartford HealthCare.
Elevating Health is funded by Hartford HealthCare. Hartford HealthCare recently celebrated the opening of the Ridge Recovery Center in Windham. Christy Scott, Vice President of Clinical Operations, describes this new state-of-the-art destination for healing.
Individuals will come if they're suffering from substance use disorder and get individualized treatment. They can stay up to 3 to 4 weeks and receive family therapy, individual therapy, group therapy, and lots of other holistic care like yoga, trail walking, acupuncture. So it's going to be a great place for people to come and heal.
For those seeking recovery, finding it close to home can sometimes be challenging.
Many individuals travel to Florida and other states that have more treatment centers, so we're hoping by doubling our capacity at Hartford HealthCare, the individuals can stay in their home state with their family and support systems close by.
To learn more, go to ctpublic.org/elevatinghealth.
So before we introduce Paul Keel all the way and talk about the ProPublica report, let me just play a little exchange, another exchange. I mean, I believe the Read My Lips quote came in the middle of a 1988 debate. Let's go fast forward to 2016. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are debating in their first debate. And here's how the exchange goes. B1 Maestro.
So you've got to ask yourself, why won't he release his tax returns? Maybe he doesn't want the American people, all of you watching tonight, to know that he's paid nothing in federal taxes, because the only years that anybody's ever seen were a couple of years when he had to turn them over to state authorities when he was trying to get a casino license, and they showed he didn't pay any federal income tax. So
that makes
if
me
he's
smart.
Paid zero, that means zero for troops, zero for vets, zero for schools or health.
So I don't know if you could hear him say that, but he said, that makes me smart. It's also a little bit reminiscent of the hotel magnate Leona Helmsley, who supposedly, this was reported by one of her employees, said, we don't pay taxes. Taxes are for little people. So now I will bring aboard Paul Keel, a reporter for ProPublica who covers taxes. In 2021, he and two other writers released the secret IRS files. Trove of never-before-seen records reveal how the wealthiest avoid income tax. So, Paul, I'd love for you to maybe comment on that clip. That attitude, that idea, is something that we have always suspected exists among the wealthy. It was a little odd that Trump, while running for president, said the smart thing to do is to create a world where you don't pay taxes. But say a little bit more about what you hear there and how it applies to the work you did.
Yeah, no, we actually did one of the stories we did. So, I mean, just a little bit of background is we received a leak of, you know, tax return information for thousands of wealthiest Americans. And, you know, in piecing through it, there's, it's not all like one thing, right? There's kind of different stripes of wealthy Americans and how much they pay in tax. A lot of it has to do with what business they're in or how they've made their wealth. And our tax system is extremely generous to people who have built their wealth in real estate, like our president, former president. And, you know, we had, it's the point of, he has, it's funny in that clip because she says zero and the Times, you know, subsequently published that he paid $750. so she's a little bit off, but not much off. But there's aspects of the code. So, you know, depreciation, which I think Trump in other quotes has like expressed his love of depreciation. Essentially, you know, the tax system rewards investment to the extent that it can wipe out all of your tax obligations if you're in the right business, so real estate, oil and gas. One thing we found is, you know, in 2020, amid like the COVID crisis, the government rushed out these stimulus payments to everyone, and the idea was that these you know, $1,600 is going out to everybody to keep everybody afloat while they're all, you know, indoors, and businesses are closed, and to assess like who deserves that, they looked at people's tax returns and said, you know, people who earn a certain amount shouldn't get this help. But that meant that people whose tax returns said, you know, that they had earned like negative $100 million in the previous year, which is just a reflection of things like depreciation or other, you know, goodies in the tax code, got stimulus checks. So we identified 18 billionaires in our data who got stimulus checks in 2020, because if you look at their tax return, you know, there is some of the worst, you know, financial years in history, but in reality, you know, they're just fine. So he's part of that sort of segment of the wealthy who are in the right business, I guess you could say.
I think one of the big surprises for me and for a lot of people, Warren Buffett is kind of a standard bearer for a wealthy person saying this tax code is lopsidedly in my favor. He famously stated that he pays a lower tax rate than his secretary, I think the Obama White House put out an entire tax reform package based on what they called the Buffett rule or something like that. So it was kind of surprising to read your article and find out that Buffett is a huge beneficiary of the kind of phenomena that you're talking about.
Yeah. So I think basically taxes boil down to, it's a percentage of a number, right? So the percentage is the tax rate and the number is what we call income. So, you know, Buffett was pointing to this percentage of, he was looking at things like dividends and capital gains, and those like forms of investment income, and they are taxed at lower rates than ordinary income like wages. And he was saying, you know, that's wrong. That's what he was focusing his arguments on. That's why he was saying he paid a lower tax rate than his secretary. But I would argue that instead of focusing on the percentage, I would focus on the number, like what is the income? So that was the first story we did when we were looking at all this data that we had, you know, like what is the most important thing? We were looking at all this, and we were just looking at people like Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and Warren Buffett, and saying, you know, geez, these people are worth $100 billion. And some of these years we're looking at, they had earned $100 billion in terms of getting that much richer. We look at their taxes, you know, Warren Buffett basically looks like someone who's, you know, wealthy, but like definitely not a $100 billionaire. So we looked at 2014 and 2018 and his taxes, he got $24 billion richer and he reported income of $125 million in that time period. And the reason is because all of his wealth is in Berkshire Hathaway, the companies that he's built, you know, since the 60s. His company doesn't pay dividends. So you buy the stock, they do engage in share buybacks. So the company has a way of, you know, kind of pumping the stock price, which makes you richer because you hold the stock, but there's no tax implications of share buybacks. At least there wasn't until recently. So you're able to get wealthier and wealthier as long as you don't sell your stock. There's no tax implications to the fact that you're getting wealthier. And there are ways for people to tap into that wealth. You know, you can borrow against your stock, for example. And in his case, he said, we asked him, you know, about these details when he ran the story. And essentially what he said was, you know, I'm building all this wealth. I'm not paying taxes on it. When I die, you know, it's going to charity, and I prefer that happen as opposed to my wealth going to pay interest on the national debt. You know, yeah. he gets to choose.
Right. Well, that's true. So let me just play devil's advocate for a second. And I'm sure you heard this kind of thing in your reporting too. There are people who would say, well, so I don't know. You're not really talking about income anymore. You're talking about the growth of wealth. And so if I buy a house for $500,000 and then a few years later it's worth $750,000, but I don't sell it, I don't have any income from the growth of that wealth. Why should that be? Why should the growth of what I own, the growth in value of what I own, be taxable? Why should that count against my tax obligations? Why am I cheating or being kind of unfair if I'm not paying taxes on that?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is a debate that actually goes back 100 years, even pretty close to when we started the income tax in this country after the 16th Amendment. And even back then, people realized there are problems with this way of narrowly defining income. So I guess, first of all, like, economists describe economic income as their way of looking at things. So if you get $100 billion richer, they would say that's income in the economic sense, because you kind of end up with some absurdities if you don't acknowledge that it is income. So, you know, if you were to like sell the stock and buy it right back, that's income. But if you don't sell it, it's, you know, the end result is the same, but we treat that differently. And, you know, it's exploited on the downside. So if your stock goes down, we have things in our tax code that are supposed to prevent you from just selling the stock and buying it right back. So it creates problems if you don't sort of acknowledge that it's income. That's not to say that it's easy from an administrative perspective to treat this straightforwardly as income. So what happened after we did our stories is the Biden administration released what they called like a billionaire minimum tax. And essentially it would be to catch, you know, examples like Buffett or other people and compare how much in taxes they actually pay. And then if they're above a certain net worth, like if 100% of millionaires and up, then it would say like, you know, you got like $10 billion and richer, and then it would apply a tax rate to that if you hadn't paid, you know, an equivalent amount in taxes through like our ordinary sense, our ordinary income tax system. That's one solution to the problem, but it does get hairy, as a lot of things in taxes do, when you try to tweak it to make it more fair.
Yeah, no, I think that should have been called the "just give us something" rule. So yeah, and some of what I'm about to describe, I was going to ask Monica Prasad about this, but I think this is better suited for you. Some of the stuff that we could talk about is almost child's play compared to the stuff that you wrote about, where people like Jeff Bezos are paying such an incredibly small amount, bordering on nothing, in taxes. But one of the things that gets debated all the time, every political cycle, almost every, you know, time taxes are being discussed, is what's called carried interest, which is a form of compensation paid to investment executives, private equity, hedge fund and venture capital managers, and they get a share of the profits. And it's divided among them proportionally. But that money is considered a return on investment. As such, the managers pay a top 20% federal tax rate instead of, if it got really big, 37%. And there's, I think, kind of a general understanding, to the degree that there's anybody, to the extent that there's anybody who understands this, the people who do understand it know that it's wrong. And it's it's like in these omnibus bills all the time. I think Kristen Sinema killed it the last time, but I think there's, I don't know, maybe you could say a little bit about how you see that. Like, why couldn't something like that be corrected, and should it be corrected?
Well, I mean, that's a case where I think everyone, a lot of people recognize the problem with it, and just lobbying has been effective and, you know, preventing fixes to it. I mean, essentially, our system is really good at taxing labor. It does a really good job of taxing wages. Very efficient, very little slippage. There's really, you know, really hard to get out of that. Like 99% in terms of, you know, reported income that is actually, like, you know, shows up in tax returns. What is much harder to tax are, you know, are coincidentally or not, the forms of income that wealthy people tend to have, which are business income and investment income. And, you know, carried interest is an example. If you want to turn something that's more of like a fee type income to something that's investment income, which gets, you know, preferable treatment from our tax code. And there's all sorts of examples of people playing games like that, but it comes down to, you know, trying to transform it into something that it's not. And it's much harder to audit, and, you know, our system is not quite good at that.
Right. No, I mean, yeah, this maybe the simple way of looking at it is this is money you're getting paid for doing your job. So that feels like,
right.
It feels like income rather than investment income. It feels like, you know, traditional money for doing your job, which gets taxed. So, you know, you're talking about things that the IRS is either good or bad at. The IRS, I think you proved pretty well that the IRS is really bad at taxing rich people. But they're actually kind of good at taxing poor people, even people who get the earned income tax credit, the EITC, which goes to, you know, the poor, the working poor. Say some more about that. What did you find out?
Yeah, so when we actually back in 2018, we were looking at, so the, you know, the IRS budget was gutted starting in 2010, 2011, to the point they lost like a third of their enforcement staff. And what happens essentially is that if you are middle income or down, particularly if you earn like wage income, you're essentially audited by a computer, because the issues involved in your audit are going to be simple enough that, you know, they have algorithms looking at stuff and they'll just spit out a letter saying, you know, with an example of the earned income tax credit, which is, you know, aimed at people who have a typical income like around $17,000, like it's pretty low on the income scale. It's supposed to reward work, and you're supposed to, and basically it goes to people who have kids. So they're working and they have kids. So the audits are some version of, you know, you said you earned this much and you had a kid, prove that your kid lived with you and that you had this much income. And then like a letter spits that out and the people are supposed to respond to it. That is something when you have like these budget cuts, you know, can stay at kind of similar levels because there's not a person touching every, you know, spending much time on every letter that's going out. Whereas if, you know, you have a wealthy person with like, you know, complicated business structure with pass-through businesses and, you know, partnerships that are nested in other partnerships, you need a skilled investigator to even begin to know what questions to ask. And so the audit rate on the wealthiest plummeted like over 80%, whereas the audits on the EITC, you know, fell a lot. They did fall, but they didn't fall nearly as quickly. And so we ended up with a situation where, you know, people who are claiming the EITC were getting audited at about the same rate as people who earned over $500,000. On average. So that was a situation before, you know, recently there have been some bills in Congress to dump a lot of money in the IRS and hope that this would be at least addressed. But that's the basic structure we have.
Yeah. It seems as though you're less likely to be audited if you are having, if you have Kentucky Derby racehorses that you're writing off than you are if you have to eat one of your horses because you're so poor. The latter person. It's more likely to get visited by the IRS, which I find mind-boggling. I guess my last question, Paul, is this story ran in 21. I don't know. Do you feel like you made a dent in any of this, or you moved this huge pile of horse manure an inch or two by revealing all this?
So, I mean, yeah, like I mentioned, the Biden administration did make this proposal, which was the first time that, you know, White House had brought in this idea of taxing unrealized gains in some form. That's a big difference. It would be a big lift, obviously, for that to happen, but it's not part of the conversation. There's been other proposals, like there's a proposal the other day of some professors who proposed, you know, taxing borrowed and like essentially. So if Elon Musk wants to borrow all this money against his Tesla stock, you know, he pays taxes on that. similar to other forms of income. So there's other ways of sort of addressing the issue. There were other fixes to tax matters and, like Build Back Better bill that sort of foundered in Congress. There was a lot of tax fixes in there that was kind of related to other coverage that we did. Didn't get through because that bill fell apart. But, you know, it's always a battle that goes back decades. And this is just kind of another chapter in that kind of struggle to make the tax system more fair. And it's often, you know, two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward, two steps back, depending on what's going on at the time.
All right. Well, Paul Keel, keep doing a good work as a reporter for ProPublica covering taxes. And if you're listening, you might want to look at the secret IRS files, the piece that they did about the super wealthy Americans and what taxes they pay. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk to somebody who doesn't want to pay taxes that are going to be used for military buildups and wars.
You're listening to the new investigative reporting podcast, In Absentia, which means you're interested in getting to the facts and uncovering the truth. If you'd like to help us continue our investigative work, consider making a donation. Visit ctpublic.org/tapsupport and contribute today. That's ctpublic.org/tapsupport. Thank you for being a part of the Accountability Project.
Many factors impact a child's achievement. To start, they need the basics like access to healthy food and quality health care. Join me, Lucy Nalpathanchil, as Connecticut Public and the Connecticut Black and Brown Student Union host a one-hour conversation about the importance of safe housing. Wednesday, May 8th at 6:30 p.m. at the Guard Arts Center in New London. Register at ctpublic.org/safehousing.
Make sure you never miss the Colin McEnroe Show by subscribing to or following our podcast on any app. It is free. The senior producer of the Colin McEnroe Show is Lily Tyson, whose boss is Katie Tolarski, whose boss is Mark Contreras, who reports to the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture. We don't know why. Back to the show.
But it probably has something to do with why your taxes are so high. Our technical producer today is Dylan Reyes, the maestro. And the producer of this show is McCusker, the Wonder Kid, and her bad cat, Penelope. All right. So one of the things I wanted to do when we first started talking about this is to talk to a war resister, somebody who pays, who doesn't want to pay taxes that go to wars. This category of person, people who refuse to pay taxes because, in fact, they supported unfair or distasteful systems, goes back at least to Henry David Thoreau, who went to jail for this. But, of course, the problem is you're going to go up against the IRS. You're going to tell them, yeah, I don't think I'm going to pay that part of my taxes. Almost nobody wants to go up against the IRS, including, in fact, the Joker. C1, Mr. Reyes, this is the Joker talking.
This should clear up your account.
$137 million?
Yes, and if I don't pay up, I'll go to jail for tax evasion. I'm crazy enough to take on Batman, but the IRS, no, thank you.
So who's crazy enough to take on the IRS? Maybe Lawrence Rosenwald, a professor of English emeritus at Wellesley College, a longtime war tax resister. Welcome to our conversation.
Good to be here.
So explain your rationale. I've hinted at it, but lay it out.
The rationale is simple. I'm a pacifist. My wife is a pacifist. It feels profoundly wrong to pay taxes to support something that we profoundly and in conscience oppose.
So given all that, I mean, one thing that you could do, I think what Thoreau did, and you're a Thoreau scholar, so you can tell me more about this, but my recollection is he just wouldn't pay his poll tax at all because of things that he found unfair, I think, including slavery. What you're doing is a little bit more prorated, right? You're trying to figure out how much of your taxes would go to activities which you regard as immoral?
That's correct. And that's partly because I believe, on the whole, in paying taxes. I like supporting government. It's only when what I would be paying taxes for is something I'm opposed to in the deep parts of my conscience that I want to refuse. So what we do is exactly what you described. We prorate it. We figure out how much we owe, and then we look at the War Resisters League pie chart of the federal budget, which seems to us a more accurate account of what federal funds are being spent for. The military percentage of the federal budget on that chart is about 27%. It's gone down, it's gone up, but it's hovered around there. And we deduct that percentage from the amount that we send to the IRS. We're not afraid to go up against the IRS, partly because we have a long experience of what the IRS can do to a refuser. In fact, we try to make our resistance both public and civil. We refuse a given amount. We send it to a progressive escrow fund where the interest is used for good causes and the principal remains available to us. And we write a letter to the IRS explaining what I just explained to you.
Okay, so it would be kind of interesting if the IRS were to respond, maybe even in the flesh. There's a cinematic precedent for this in the movie Stranger Than Fiction. Let's hear Maggie Gyllenhaal. Her character confronts a tax man coming to audit her, played by Will Ferrell, C2, sir.
Listen, I'm a big supporter of fixing potholes and erecting swing sets and building shelters. I am more than happy to pay those taxes. I'm just not such a big fan of the percentage that the government uses for national defense, corporate bailouts, and campaign discretionary funds. So I didn't pay those taxes. I think, actually, I sent a letter to that effect with my return.
Would it be the letter that begins, "Dear Imperialist Swine"?
Yes.
So, I'm sure you don't begin your letter that way, but does the IRS ever respond when you do this?
Only once in 1974, I think. That was when, before I got married, so first person singular pronouns are in order. I was refusing to pay the phone tax, a tax that was instituted to help fund the Vietnam War. It was a kind of gateway drug for war tax resisters. It was low risk and small amount. But an IRS agent came to my door, a handsome Texan seeming suit wearing IRS agent. He rang the bell. I let him in. He said, "Mr. Rosenwald, I want to know whether you're going to pay this tax or not." And I said, I'm not, for the reasons I've stated. I'm opposed to the war and I don't want to fund it. And he said, "Well, I understand that. I guess that means that I'm going to go have to locate your bank and collect the money there," which he did.
That's
only encounter I've ever had with an IRS agent.
It's so Nixon administration, you know, I mean, kind of Nixon famously weaponized the IRS against his enemies. I'm not saying that's what happened here, but it's on brand. So I don't know. I mean, you're continuing to do this. Do you think it makes a difference?
That's a very good question. I do think it makes a difference, but I don't think that the war tax resistance community has ever organized itself as a political movement aiming at a particular political goal. I don't think that the war tax resistance community has succeeded in reducing the military budget. I think it would be ludicrous to claim that that's been an effect of the war tax resistance community's actions. I do think that it's really valuable to have a significant community of people taking a principled stand publicly, even if the effect at this moment of that stand isn't discernible. Things happen slowly. Effects are the relation between cause and effect is hard to trace. There's sometimes those effects are individual, sometimes they're collective. There's a famous story, you may know this, about what led to Daniel Ellsberg releasing the Pentagon Papers. He'd been listening to the testimony of a draft resister, then war tax resister, subsequently a guy named Randy Keeler. Ellsberg was so moved by what Randy Keeler did that he thought, I have to do something. And he released the Pentagon Papers. Effects like that, slow, difficult to trace. I think those effects are happening. And as I said, I think it's valuable for a society to have a group of people taking a moral stand, even if the effects are hard to discern or slow in coming.
All right. So we should say there is something called the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. There are war tax resistors organizations and chapters all over the place. If you're interested in this, I mean, approach with caution, but if you're interested in this, indulge that interest anyway. Lawrence Rosenwald is a professor of English emeritus at Wellesley College and a longtime war tax resistor. We have got to go. I got to go pay my taxes. Set it on the-